Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass!"
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Napalm smells best in the evening. It's not worth believing what you heard. Soylent Green, really just a trinket, not a people biscuit. Take my word. It's been said you can't handle the truth, but that ain't so. How do I know I was there too?
Hello, listeners, and welcome to a special run of guest-hosted episodes of I Was There Too, the show where normally I talk to people who were there in the great and interesting moments of film history. But for the next 2 months, I'm stepping aside to let a handful of special people take over the hosting duties, because I'm off getting married and honeymooned. So I'll be back directly. But until then, this run of shows, both in the guests as well as the hosts, will be some really, really great stuff. How do I know? Because I know who the guests are, and I know who the hosts are, and I will be listening to the interviews as they come just like you, and I can't wait. So today, I give you my friend Maria Blasucci, and if all goes as it's supposed to while I'm on this break, my now lovely wife Amanda Lunn, talking to Jack Greenidge from Rebel Without a Cause, Spartacus, King Creole, and more. Stay subscribed to I Was There Too, and write a review of this show on iTunes if you can. And if you ever want to dig back into the archives to hear great episodes like Jeanette Goldstein telling me all about playing the badass Vasquez in Aliens, or a whole episode dedicated to various passengers on the bus from the movie Speed, just visit Stitcher Premium or Howl.fm. Thank you for listening, and on with the show.
The film, Rebel Without a Cause. The year, 1955. The role, Moose. The actor, Jack Greenidge.
Hi, everyone.
Hello.
I'm Maria Blasucci.
And I'm Amanda Lund.
And we're filling in for Matt Gourley.
Yes, we are proud and honored that he entrusted us with one episode of his brilliant podcast, I Was There Too.
And you may know us from Pistol Shrimps Radio. You may know us from Ghost Girls.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. you may have listened to The Complete Woman,
mm-hmm,
or Complete Joy.
You may have seen Mascots, or you may have seen Goosebumps.
You may have. we've also made vocal appearances on the Super Ego, mm-hmm, podcast.
So that's
also Matt Gourley is my companion and life partner.
Yeah, so we're very happy to be here. And we have a very special guest today.
Yes.
He was wonderful as a guest star on Ghost Girls. He was in the retirement home episode where he played Wally, a budding geologist.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, which was a really great and sweet character. And actually, I think it was kind of similar to some of the characters he's played in the famous movies we're going to talk to him about today.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe the same character even, all grown up.
So please join us in welcoming Jack Greenidge.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Now, Jack is a Hollywood legend here with us today because he was in, I couldn't believe it. You were in two of the biggest movies of the 50s and 50s.
Yes, I wrote it down. The year it came out, I think, was
1953 or 4?
55.
55.
Was what my information.
Rebel Without a Cause.
Yes.
And in 1958? Was or seven was King Creole with
King Creole with Elvis Presley.
Yes,
So that's exciting.
I have to say, Rebel Without a Cause was a movie I thought I had seen, but then when I rewatched it for this interview, I realized, oh, I've never seen this. I was just only familiar with some of like the super iconic scenes, but I was kind of like blown away by how sad that movie is.
Well, it's interesting, you know, when people find out that I was in the movie, whatever, I played the character of Moose, they go, oh, I've heard of that. I don't think I've ever seen it, you know. And then every once in a while it's on Turner Classic Movies, uh-huh, or CNN's going to do something on the Rebel Kings, I think in September or November, on why he became such a big famous star, you know. With only three movies.
Right. And he died, and James Dean, didn't he, Amanda was saying he died before the premiere of Rebel Without a Cause. Is that true?
He just finished Giant, mm-hmm, but he hadn't done some, there's some voiceovers that he had to do that Nick Adams filled in for the, when he's old at the banquet scene. Now, I remember going to a premiere or a preview in Westwood for Rebel Without a Cause, and Jimmy was there.
Okay.
So he did see it. You know, so.
Right. So let's just go from the beginning. So how did you get, so you play Moose, who's one of the gang members in Buzz's, in Buzz's gang, and your Dennis Hopper is also one of the members of the gang.
Correct, correct.
And so how did you get that role?
Well, it's interesting. At the time I was supposed to do another movie. Forbidden Planet.
Oh.
I'd even had a wardrobe fitting. And the interviews for Rebel Without a Cause came up, and I remember going up stairs. Hoyt Bowers was the casting man, and they said, go upstairs. And my agent started to go with me, and he said, Isabel, you stay here. So when I went up, I met David Weisbar and Nick Ray. And, you know, they asked you all sorts of questions, you know, how old are you? You know, of course I lied, you know, then in those days you could lie.
Right, yeah. They couldn't figure it out.
So you lied about your age?
Oh, I lied. I was 24, you know.
You were, and you were playing what, 17?
17, 18, and they said, how old are you? And I thought, I don't want to have a teacher on the set. So I said I was 21, and they said, do you think you can play a 17-year-old? And I said, well, I don't really even believe I'm 21.
Because you're really 24.
Yeah, because funny things happen, you know. You feel like, gee, I'm really an adult, and I did really well in this interview, and I looked down, and I had two different socks on.
Oh, no. Well, that's probably
And I started
endearing
to leave, and I opened the door to the closet, you know, to leave, you know. But there were several other interviews after that, you know.
And so you're saying interviews, like, you didn't have to audition reading lines?
That was later on. There was a soundstage that burned down at Warner Brothers, so they called. There must have been 30 people up for all the roles, and we just sat on the cement, and Nick Ray gave us a script and said, read it. Fortunately, that day, you know, some days you're really there. The line sort of jumped off the page at me.
Uh-huh.
I was the first one to read the character of Goon, and it was supposed to be in a drive-in, and Goon was on drugs and was just flipping out. And what happened after that, since I'd gone first, everyone tried to copy me.
Oh, no.
You know, and I think that's what you do instinctively if you hear somebody else read. You just go for that. Then there were other interviews, finally a screen test with Jimmy and some other people, and then they said, okay, you know, we book you, you know.
What was that feeling like?
It was really wonderful. I was driving down the freeway. I had an old Ford, and I remember the hood flew up on the freeway, and I thought, oh, no, not now.
So had you been Had you worked a lot before doing Rebel? And if so, like what sorts of projects and characters were you playing?
Well, the first thing I did was meet Corliss Archer. I played a traveling salesman, you know. That was my first television show that I did.
Uh-huh.
And the director, God, what was his name? Wonderful man. After that, used me and used me and used me. Every time there was a young man, of course, I was young then. And then I did two films. One was Interrupted Melody with Eleanor Parker. She played an Australian opera singer who was paralyzed, and it's a true story. And I'm in the hospital, I'm paralyzed, but I play for her while she sings, you know. And then a movie called Lady Godiva of Coventry with Maureen O'Hara, and I got to kiss her hand.
Oh, my.
So what was the set of Rebel like? Because you had some Hollywood icons there. You had James Dean, Natalie Wood, Dennis Hopper. I mean, what was the, were you guys all friends with one another?
Beverly Long and I were friends. We'd gone to college together and done plays at City College.
Was that the girl who plays your girlfriend?
The blonde with the blonde ponytail.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had an interview for Rebel. And I thought, Beverly'd be great for this movie. So I went to school, and she'd gone back to San Diego. And I called her in San Diego, and I said, there's a movie here that you should be in, that you should be up for, you know. And I said, come back, you know. So she came back, and she called her agent. He said, oh, they've seen every girl in town, you know, unless they don't like them, they're not going to see you.
Right.
And all of a sudden, there's Beverly.
Wow.
Yeah.
She must have been grateful to you.
Yeah.
I wish I had a friend who'd do that for me.
Oh, well, I've tried.
No one's taken the bait.
But, you know, it had to be other aspects that got her the role, you know.
Really. Yeah. Yeah. And was she your age as well?
She's a little younger. She's gone now, you know. Oh. But she was a little younger than me. I think Jimmy and I were the oldest. We're 24 at the time, you know. Maybe Nick Adams was older, too, you know. But everybody just passed away last year, really.
Oh man. So I had heard that Crunch was actually in a real gang when he was in high school, and that he kind of instructed you guys on what that was really like. Is that true? We got a coy shrug.
Well, we were all in gangs in high school. I mean, I'm sure you were too, but we didn't call them gangs. We called them clubs.
Okay. But were you jumping people and playing chicken?
No. I almost got kicked out of high school because I was at a party where people were smoking pot. But then they called it, what did they call it then? Weed, I guess, or marijuana, you know. That's the only incident that I know of, you know. I ran into a girl who went to high school with Frank Mazzola, and she said, we were in clubs, not gangs, you know. So who knows, really, you know. And those are good stories.
Yeah.
And they're good publicity.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe that's what it was, huh?
Yeah.
So what was James Dean like? What was he seen? He seems like a tortured guy, but maybe really nice.
He was really nice. In the beginning of the film, he stayed away from us, as for the character he should have, you know.
Right.
And as the film went on and we got warmed up, we got to be more friendly. I remember I always said, good morning, Jimmy, you know, and he never said good morning to him. I thought, well, I'm not going to say good morning to him anymore.
Right.
And one morning I walked in and he said, good morning, Jack Greenidge.
Oh, wow. That must have felt good. I feel like that's a real power move when you kind of ignore someone, but then you reveal that you actually know their first and last name.
Yeah.
You know, it makes you feel special.
Yeah, that would have made me melt, honestly.
So, but at this point, was he at his heartthrob status by the time he was doing Rebel?
No. He'd done East of Eden, which I think he was brilliant in. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a brilliant film. They talk about Rebel Without a Cause, but I think it really East of Eden was the. I know after we realized we were going to do the role of Beverly and I, we went to see East of Eden and were bowled over by the performance. It was just unbelievable, you know. What he does with Raymond Massey in the scene where I think he's put the stuff on a freezer train and it's rotted or something, you know, and he's trying to show his father how much love he has. And there's two styles of acting that you see with Raymond Massey and Jimmy Dean, where I have heard that Raymond Massey was so pulled back by the emotion that Jimmy gave to him that he was just stunned, you know.
Wow.
So it's interesting as films go on and you see different forms of it. I know, I'm sure you're watching television now. We were just talking about how people mug so much in the sitcoms in the early days.
Yeah, I was watching with Matt, actually. We were watching Bewitched, and I just noticed half of, probably more like 85% of the acting is eyebrow work and making goofy faces to the camera. But you don't see that in the dramas, like Rebel Without a Cause. I mean, the acting is so incredible from everyone, even the characters. I feel like they're more fleshed out and, like, more evolved than anything you would see today. But, I mean, so James Dean was kind of like a method actor, right?
Oh, he went to
Stella Adler, was it?
Not Stella Adler, what's the school in New York?
The New
Strasbourg,
school?
Or?
No, not Sandy Meisner. Marilyn Monroe also went there.
She went with the Lee Strasberg.
Yes, Lee Strasberg. Lee Strasberg, you know.
So he
did a Broadway play called The Immoralist, you know, and got the, I think it was the Drama Critics Award or something, you know.
Was he short? He seemed kind
of... He was my size. We were the same size. As a matter of fact, in some of the scenes when he's left... It's my shoulder in the over.
Really?
Yeah, or my hand patting Salmini on the head, you know.
Wait, did you get to wear the red leather jacket?
No, I wore the brown sport coat.
Oh, okay.
That's hilarious. And so as far as like when you were filming the group scenes with the rest of the gang members, was that kind of like a loose, goofy, improv-y environment, or was everyone pretty serious?
No, it was totally scripted. We did one scene one day that took most of the day where we improv'd, and it was so bad they couldn't use it.
Really? What was that scene?
It was at the observatory, figuring on what we're going to do to Jimmy Dean's character.
Uh-huh.
You know, in the rumble or whatever.
Right.
But your character, Moose, he's like the sweet gang member.
I'm the one that says... Do we really have to do this? Sort of whiny, you know. But it's interesting. The credits are wrong.
Why?
Well, when I went in to sign my contract, I looked at the contract and it said Chick. And I said to the casting person, oh, my character is Moose. You know, it's not Chick. And she said, oh, just sign it.
Oh, my God.
Wait, so you're credited as Chick?
I'm credited as Chick and Nick Adams as Moose.
Oh.
But in the film... Frank Mazzola, who plays Crunch, calls me Moose, so.
Yeah, and you get those cars. So you're the character who gets the cars for the chick you run.
Yeah,
and you call James Dean and Buzz over to look at the cars. And so really, you're responsible for Buzz's death.
That's true. And that was an interesting scene because for the two cars, we were on the Warner Ranch. And there was a tiny little hill, not a big hill. And they had dug trenches in the ground for the cars to go straight ahead. And the cars were up on ramps. So Mushy Callahan doubled Jimmy as the jump out of the car. And the cars went down the ramps. The cars went over. One car got stuck, didn't go over the cliff. And we ran to the cliff. And then we stopped acting, and Nick said, keep acting, keep acting, like it had gone over. And so we finished that, and I don't know how they finally did the other car going over the edge. It looks, if you really watch it and sort of stop frame through the thing, it looks like it might be arted in, the other car, seeing the other car underneath. And then the rest of the stuff was done on a soundstage 7 or 21 at Warner Brothers, you know, all the close-ups and whatever.
And that, so you're in one of the most famous scenes ever in all of film history, which is the Griffith Observatory. See, I mean, that's like an iconic set piece, kind of, is. And the Griffith Observatory now has a James Dean bust on
I have a picture of the bust.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, I brought some pictures for you to see if you want.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, that's great.
And we can even put them up on the...
There's a website that people can then see some of the photos.
So what was it like filming up at the observatory? Did you...
Well, it was really fun, you know. And we'd filmed 2 weeks, I think, in black and white. because all of a sudden they realized that, I think there's a legal thing that you can't do CinemaScope in black and white. I don't know exactly what it is, but we switched to color, Technicolor, or Warner Color, I guess. And then they all had to change all our wardrobe and makeup and stuff like that, and we started all over again.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. So we worked 9 weeks on the film, which was wonderful. Wow. Beverly and I went down to Music City and bought our first television sets.
Oh, that's great.
That is so sweet. That is great.
And you're sitting next to James Dean in the planetarium scene when he's doing his, when you guys are looking up at the end of the right. world thing. What was that like to film?
That's the whole moose thing, isn't it?
Yeah, the moo.
When they go moo.
Yeah, yeah.
It's interesting. We had a... an interview at the museum, I think the Writers Guild put it together, where we were all up on stage, and Stuart Stern, who was the writer, talked about the moo thing with Jimmy. Building the character of Jimmy Dean for Rebel Without a Cause, he worked really well with Nick Ray and Stuart Stern, and they built the things for the best things that he did and all his little idiosyncrasies. Mm. So I've heard that other films, directors had difficulties with him. On Rebel, there was no difficulty.
Was that because he was kind of had some more control and was able to call more shots on set?
He knew exactly how the film was going because it had been written for him, written exactly for him and what is good for him to do. It's like, I mean, years ago, I don't know if you remember Douglas Fairbanks Sr., you know, I mean, he was very athletic, but everything was built to the best height that he jumped or the best thing that he could do, you know, athletically. So he looked like he was this wonderful person, you know.
Right. This played to his strengths.
Yeah. And so they built Rebel Without a Cause to his strengths.
Right. Natalie Wood, what was she like?
There was just the start of her rise to fame, you know. I mean, she was a wonderful actress, and she worked well with Jimmy. She was very malleable. Is that the right word?
She could change. She could change it up if the director wanted her to.
She knew what she was doing. You know, I remember her in the tests. There was a test where we all went on the back lot, and they told us to bring our cars and park them. So it was going to be like a rumble, you know, whatever. And there was five boys and Buzz. And they said, I said, well, which boy do you want me to read? They said, oh, just learn all the lines. So I said, okay, so we're out there. There must have been, again, 30 people, you know, women and men. And Buzz, they said, okay, action. And Buzz said his line, and nobody answered. So I said I said the line. And Buzz said his line. Nobody said this line again. And I did all the boys. And pretty soon a car pulls up, which we didn't know about. Perry Lopez, Frank, and a couple other guys jumped out, and this other actor grabbed me and said, we're supposed to fight.
What?
So there's a big fight, you know, and some people's cars got dented and some people got hurt. But, you know, and later on I said, I'd love to see that film. They said, there was no film in the camera.
What?
You know.
So that was a
test. Rascals.
That was a test, yeah. No, Nick, to save money.
And Natalie Wood was there?
Natalie wasn't there. I saw her there, but I didn't see her in the scene, you know.
Right.
So they never did it over again, and I did all the parts, you know. So the fortunate things happened for me, you know, so made me stand out a bit, you know, from the rest of the people.
Right.
And then what about the knife fight scene? Was that – because today I feel like if you did something like that, it would be so choreographed, like, and so tedious to shoot. Was it like that, filming that?
They did it in a couple hours. You know, Frank said he staged the knife fight scene, but I don't remember any rehearsal on the knife fight at all. Jimmy did get cut, but he did have a vest underneath, so he wouldn't really get cut. It was just a smart little cut on his arm. But you know, they blew it up again. It's publicity, you know. But in any knife scene or any guns, as you know, everything's rubber.
Right.
Right.
You know.
So these were rubber knives?
Rubber knives, yeah.
But he still
got cut. Except for the close-up.
Oh, he got cut on the close-up, I assume.
Yeah.
That knife fight was so harrowing for me to watch. Just mm-hmm. That would be my worst nightmare, to get just a tiny little stab like that. I guess it's better than a deep stab, but I had never seen that before.
Well, it's interesting, you know, camera work and stuff, how things look really, really hard and really difficult and dangerous. And sometimes they are, you know.
Yeah. That was, yeah, I loved that scene, though.
I mean, I've loved that movie since I had a poster of it in my room growing up.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah.
Really? Mm-hmm. So who was your favorite character?
Well,
Moose?
Yeah, it was Moose.
careful.
James Dean's character was probably...
You thought he was hot stuff, huh?
Yeah, he was hot stuff. I mean, Sal Mineo was pretty cool, too, but he was tortured.
Yes.
Well, I was only 16.
Was he when you shot that? And yeah, what was he like? What was his personality in real life?
He was really a nice kid, very dedicated, and he'd been on Broadway. He played the youngest son in the old Brenner thing. What's the musical about the lady going to
King and I?
King and I. He played the young son on Broadway with Gertrude Lawrence, you know, mm-hmm. and it was in Subject Was Roses, I think, you know, as a young. So he had some theater background, you know, he knew what he was doing, you know. It's unfortunate at that time the ethnic mix didn't have more really good parts for him, you know.
Well, that was a killer part that he got to play in Rebel.
Yeah.
All three of the main stars of that movie, though, all died before their time, really.
Yeah.
He got, Sal Mineo got stabbed, did he not? And Natalie Wood drowned, mm-hmm. and James Dean got killed in a car accident.
Yeah. I may be the only one left.
Of all the gang members?
Of the whole film.
Wow.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, I may be. I'm not sure. You know.
Yeah.
I mean, Buzz and Steffi Sidney and Beverly passed away last year.
Mm-hmm. Did you keep in touch with them?
Yep, we all kept in touch,
That's
you know.
Nice.
Yeah, especially Beverly and I. As a matter of fact, Beverly became a casting agent for commercials. And that's how I got my manager today. It was through Beverly, so.
Wow.
Aww.
It's sort of payback.
What was this is just more of a broad question. What was craft service like?
Craft service.
Well,
Maria has a real obsession with food, free food.
And I'm just interested in like set life in, you know, the mid-50s. Like how did it differ from today's?
Well, today I don't work that much.
Well, I guess from the Ghost Girls set.
I remember is if you had an early call, there was always breakfast. You know, there was always breakfast for you. You could get anything during the day if you really wanted it. There were a lot more sweets, you know, then.
Yeah. Oh, really? But like candy or homemade sweets?
Donuts and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Wagon Train had an open bar.
What?
You know? Yeah.
They had you could drink on set?
Yeah, yeah. On Rebel Without a Cause, we did a 24-hour day, and they let the crew go. They kept us, and there was a trailer. They got a new crew. There was a trailer that was just filled with any kind of liquor you wanted, you know.
Would you partake?
No, I wouldn't drink while I'm working, you know.
Who would?
I guess maybe the crew. I mean, you know, I don't know how it is today. I think there was a lot of... Liquor was a thing that you sort of did as a grown-up in those days.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I stopped drinking years ago, so I don't know how people really react to liquor on sets today.
I think it's more – I think it's there, but it's more – maybe the crew people would have a beer or something, but I don't see it ever.
Sometimes I mean, sweets, craft tables don't have as much sweets anymore.
That's for sure.
Yeah. But that's recent too.
Yeah. Yeah. Everyone wants those veggies.
Yeah. Nice crudité.
So people don't get too hyper.
Oh, yeah.
Or too fat. You got to have actress food on set.
That's true. A nice Luna bar. Never hurt anybody.
Sure.
So should we move on to King Creole?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Any like stories that you have about Rebel that you didn't get to tell, or any, you know, final thoughts about that whole experience?
I talked about getting the role. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I did that. The knife fight, the 24-hour day. We went into golden time.
Oh, what's that mean?
That means you got a full day's pay for every hour you work.
No. Oh, my God. Wow. I've never heard of Golden Time before.
Well, maybe they don't have it anymore. Well,
yeah, I don't think so.
I think SAG would be on you pretty hard if everyone would be calling SAG going, we've been working for 22 hours.
But, you know, and we got a lot of meal penalties, you know. Mm-hmm. So we made a lot. At the time, we thought we were making a lot of money. I think all the gang got $350 a week.
So was Rebel a big hit when it came out, or was it kind of a slow burn?
I think it's been a slow burn, really, because I remember we were all together. The gang was all together going to a party when it came over the radio that Jimmy had been killed.
Oh.
You know, and because we all thought, oh, this is really going to do something for our careers, you know.
Yeah.
And we thought, oh, now, of course, very selfishly.
Yeah.
What's going to happen, you know? But then it came out and.
That's too bad.
And do you think it, being in Rebel Without a Cause, did it open a lot of doors for you career-wise?
I don't know whether it really did or not. I was working a bit. I changed agents at the time and got a really wonderful, I mean, I had a good agent before, but then somebody said, oh, you have to change. You can't stay with her anymore, you know. So I got this other agent who I found, and I'm just realizing now how important he was, because finally I got to a point I didn't have to go on interviews, you know.
You got offers.
I just got offers, you know.
Wow.
And when I went to see him, I thought, oh, I hope he handles me. And he said, oh, sure. I mean, I was amazed, you know, that he just said yes right away. So I guess it did help. Looking back, I really don't know. You know, I mean, people now say, you were in that movie, Rebel Without a Cause, you know. Some people that know, and other people go, what?
Yeah.
And Dennis Hopper on set, what was he like?
Dennis was Dennis. Sometimes he'd say four-letter words and they'd have to cut and redo the scene.
Oh, no.
You know.
Right.
And Nick would get mad at him. Nick Ray would get mad at him and say, Jack, take his line.
Oh, really?
Well, there weren't that many lines anyway.
Yeah,
you know.
But
Dennis was
favor.
Under contract to the studio.
Oh.
You know, so I never saw Dennis in any of the auditions.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I bet he wanted the James Dean role. Do you think that he was coveting that role secretly?
No, I don't think so. I don't think he was at that point. He'd just done a Medic, which got him the contract at Warner Brothers. I remember going to Dennis's dressing room after one of the shoots one day with Natalie and Nick Adams, you know. And Natalie had gone to the bathroom, and they were both talking about her, and they said, I'm going to hold on to her bra strap.
Why?
Meaning for their careers.
Oh. It's the female version of the bootstrap.
Oh. She seems like a sweetheart, though.
She was, but she really knew what she was doing.
She
know.
Was there for
was
us. She was there to work.
Was she dating the director?
Well, supposedly that's the story, you know. I mean, our first day out at the planetarium, Nick says to her, what do you have on? She said, oh, they padded me. They padded her hips and bust. And he said, take it off. The wardrobe people went crazy because the things really didn't fit then. And at that point, I thought,
how would he have known?
Yeah.
Oh.
So that's the only inkling I have, you know.
I love
that's
that.
That's the story, you know.
I do love her outfit in that film, the pink little polo shirt.
Oh, uh-huh. That's yeah. So cute. Yeah, I like it in the beginning when she's all in red and she's supposed to be kind of dressed sexy, but it's like the most conservative outfit. It's just red.
I was sitting in Nick Ray's office when Moss Mabry was the wardrobe man, came up and she was in that dress to show Nick the dress. And he said, the fur collar, that's from an old Betty Davis coat.
Oh, wow. That's cool. God.
And Beverly's skirt, they said Beverly's skirt was an old Betty Davis's throw off.
Hand-me-downs. Betty Davis hand-me-downs.
We should
so
all be
anyway,
so lucky.
So anyway, silly things.
Yeah.
I love that.
I love the stories.
About the padding.
You wish someone would go, what do you have on? You'd go, this is
padding.
Just me.
I have my jeans padded.
She was 16, you know.
Oh, my
maybe
gosh.
There weren't many hips there.
I think it was just the silhouette that everyone wanted was that.
Yeah.
Now, speaking of silhouettes, that banana dancer in King Creole.
The what?
The banana dancer.
In King Creole?
When she does that banana dance. Do you remember that?
No, I don't.
Well, Amanda's obsessed with it.
Well, I just watched it this morning. So there's one part where there's a woman doing a cabaret at the bar, and she's singing the song about bananas, but she's in this amazing banana costume. It's like a little banana dress, but it has real bananas hanging off of it, and when she does a little hip movement, she detaches one and throws it into the audience.
And there's like a whistle that goes.
I wonder if that, you know, Josephine Baker... do you know who Josephine Baker was?
No.
She was a black singer in the 20s and 30s who went to Paris and became so famous. But that was her thing, a banana costume.
Really? I have to have one.
So I wonder if they used that for the girl.
Maybe it was the inspiration. But why don't we transition into talk about Elvis.
Yeah, you working with the king. So you had a very endearing, beautiful role in King Creole where you play Dummy, and you're in a gang of bad boys that's kind of connected to this mob in New Orleans. But you're the one with the heart of gold, but you also have a speech impediment where you can't talk properly. And Elvis is you're the boss of your gang, brings Elvis into the gang and is like, hey, you help us turn, you know, tricks or whatever, and then the gang boss doesn't give you your fair cut, and Elvis, you know, gives you what you're rightly deserved, and then in the end, you save his life.
That sounds accurate to me. Did she get it right?
Should I speak? Because I was playing a dummy. A non-hearing. I shouldn't say that. A non-hearing person.
So, you were?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought
you thought he just had a speech impediment.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. So how was that when you auditioned for that? Was that an offer?
No. I had to audition. It's interesting because I had two auditions that day, one for the Paramount picture with Hal Wallace and another for a television show. And I thought, I'm going to get the television show, you know. And I was waiting outside of Hal Wallace's office. And it was like a hospital room, you know, all sort of gray colored. And they said, okay, Mr. Wallace, we'll see you now. And this door opened that went up like 10 feet. I went in the room. It was like thousands of books, thousands of awards. And at the end of a block away was Hal Wallace sitting at his desk. I was so overwhelmed. And there was Michael Curtiz and the associate producer. And I can't remember his name now. At the end of the desk, and they interviewed me. I could not utter a word. Fortunately, it was for the part of a non-speaking person.
Wow, that's incredible.
And this was on Paramount?
This was at Paramount, yeah. And afterwards, what was his name? Anyway, afterwards, the associate producer said, you have the worst interview personality of any actor I've ever met.
Oh my God.
But I did get the role.
That's great. So did you film in New Orleans, or you filmed all your stuff out
no,
here?
No, we went to New Orleans, you know, to do the filming. I had asked before we left if the fight with Walter Matthau, if I would have a double for the fight at the end of the scene, and they said yes. And it got to that day, and they said, okay, we're going to do that scene now. And I said, oh, do I have a double? And they said, no. I said, does Walter have a double? They said, yes. And they said, okay. I said, this is my last shot of the film. I said, you know, if I get hurt, you know, I may never work again. And I didn't know what to do. And I thought, good Lord, you know, if I don't do it, I'll probably never work in Hollywood again. Oh. And Elvis, I got aside with Elvis and I said, you know, I really don't know what to do. If I don't do it, you know, I'll probably never work again. And he said, if you do it, you may get hurt.
Right.
So we were in a little shack out in the bay, and there was this long walkway, and I walked off the set and went, and I didn't have a dressing room. I sat in the limousine. And finally they came and came to me and said, can we have your clothes? They didn't even have double clothes. And so one of the crew did the fall, and then they said, will you get in the water? And I said, of course I'll get in the water, you know. And the scene
is that you and Walter Matthau get in a scuffle over a gun, and then you both fall off a pier into the water.
Yeah, it's a 10-foot fall.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what was in the water. Maybe if it hadn't been my last shot of the film, I might have done it, you know?
Right.
But I did ask before, but you should ask your agent to see if you're going to have a double, not the assistant director.
Right.
Yeah. So you learn things, you know, as you go on.
So were they mad at you?
I don't know if they were mad or not. You know, Colonel Parker was on the set and said, give the kid some more money. He'll do it.
Would you have?
No.
So you met Colonel Parker, who was Elvis's caretaker.
He was on the set every day playing poker.
What was he? Did you get bad news vibes from him, or did you?
He was just there and Elvis's entourage, you know.
Right.
A little intimidated by the entourage, you know.
But Elvis seemed.
One day when we were doing one of the first scenes in the dime store, where we robbed the dime store, there was a lull on the set. He got his guitar out and played and sang gospel songs, you know.
That's nice.
Which was it's really memorable and nice, you know.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the woman, woman who plays his love interest is now a nun, isn't that?
Yeah.
Right?
Dolores.
Dolores Hart.
Is she still living?
Yeah.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
She became a nun like a year after that.
Really?
Yeah.
I could see myself doing that.
After you get to work with all this, just going, I give it all up.
Yeah, Jan Shepherd, who played Elvis's sister. Got to know Jimmy quite well and to know Mother Dolores quite well. And we did. We were asked to come back to what is his place? And
Graceland.
Graceland. Yeah, we were asked to come back to Graceland and do an interview and talk to people and stuff. It was really interesting because Mother Dolores interviewed us on a screen. You know, she did it. They did a film thing of her, and then she introduced us, and we came through the screen onto the stage, which was sort of fun.
So this was after, when did you first go to Graceland?
Oh gosh, this was a couple years ago.
Oh, okay. So did Elvis ever say, hey, come on down to Graceland with me?
I didn't get the message. But I did get Christmas cards every year from him.
You
That's
did?
So great.
Yeah.
What were the Christmas cards like?
I mean, they were signed, you know, but it just said Merry Christmas and whatever, you know. I think I saved one. I don't know if I have any of the rest of them.
So it seemed to me that that most of the Elvis movies I've seen or heard of seemed like more kind of fluffy, you know. And this one, it felt like they were almost trying to make him a James Dean type.
Yeah.
Character. Well, he was very interested in James Dean. He did ask me how it was working with James Dean.
He did.
And what do you say about working with another actor? You know, he knows his lines. He's dedicated. He's concentrating. You know, he knows what he's doing. You know.
Was Elvis a dedicated actor?
Yeah. Always knew his lines. There was no problem. I never saw him out of makeup.
Really?
And was he wearing a lot of makeup when you saw him?
You did wear more makeup then,
right.
You know. And his hair was always dyed black, you know. I think after that movie, he did a movie where he played twins and his hair was dyed black and it stayed black after that, you know.
Yeah.
I know when we were in New Orleans, we were going out. We were going out to the set one day, and we're sitting in the limousine. And he said, do you want to see something? I said, oh, okay. And he rolled down the window. There's thousands of girls
really?
Around. And he yelled out and said, hi there, how are you? It's Elvis here. They screamed and started running towards the car, and he said to the driver, drive.
Did you get a lot of girls being like, hey, can you introduce me to your pals, Elvis and Jimmy?
No. No one came up to me. No one was interested.
Oh, poor Moose.
Poor dummy.
Yeah. Poor dummy and Moose. Did you feel like, did you see kind of the parallels between those two characters in a way, dummy and Moose, or for you, were they very different characters?
Well, I wore the same jacket in both films.
Did you? Do you
it was
still
my,
have it?
My jacket. No, it got ruined when I fell in the water.
Oh. No.
Yeah.
You shouldn't have done that.
Yeah. Well, who knows? Today you save everything.
Yeah.
You know.
This was before. It's crazy to me that the Colonel was on set because the Colonel is kind of what made Elvis go down. He was like a very bad influence.
He
on
was
Elvis.
An enabler or.
Well, didn't he take, I don't really know, 50% of.
He basically ruined Elvis's life. And my boyfriend's a big Elvis fan, and he said that Elvis was on methamphetamines at the time of filming.
King Creole?
King Creole.
Really?
Oh, really?
That's
just before he went in the army.
Right. Did you ever see anything? Did you ever see, or did you see him and the colonel have like a strange relationship in any way? It just seemed very normal, like he was like a manager of some sort, or
he was always there, but I never heard any. The only, as I told you, the only thing I heard was pay the kids some more money.
So he was looking out for you. Wow, that's just crazy. I mean, thinking back on it and you being in these situations with, you know, and being part of these Hollywood, historical Hollywood moments is just, you know, that's so awesome.
Does it seem cool to
you? It's just as awesome as doing the film with the Ghost Girls.
Oh.
It was just as much fun, you know. I mean, you were wonderful. You really were.
Oh.
You know, I'm so proud of you both doing something for your careers.
Thank you. Well, no one else is doing it.
Well,
so, yeah.
I mean, I just waited for. I didn't do anything to promote. I did take ads out when I was on television and television shows in the trade papers and stuff like that. I did have a publicity manager, you know, and he got 5% of my salaries when I worked, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I did things like that, but to build your own show, I think, is just brilliant.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're really proud of Ghost Girls. Mm-hmm. If you haven't seen it, check it out. You can go to Vimeo and watch it there. And the retirement home episode
is great,
where you can see Jack.
Yeah.
And so you mentioned earlier, before we started the interview, that you felt like there was more work back in the 50s and 60s. And
well, television had just started. I don't think they knew what was doing. There were tons of Westerns.
Oh, yeah.
And there'd be one star, you know. I think Wagon Train had four principals, but then they had these stories that they hired, you know, so many people. It was just, well, I did four Wagon Trains, you know. And in those days, you could do the show more than once. I mean, I had an interview a couple months ago, and the casting person, and there was this list, you know, on the list, and I said, how many people are you seeing for this role? And she said, honey, I have to see 30 people, you know. And I said, and you can't be on the show once you've been on it.
Right. And then because I know back then that was when the studio system had the contracts. Was that like a dream of yours back then, being like, oh, if I make a good impression, maybe they'll contract me?
I never thought of it, really. It never entered my head. And Dennis, I think, was the only person under contract. Mm-hmm. Natalie wasn't under contract when she started the picture, or either that was put together when she got the role.
Right.
Because there were so many girls up for the role, you know.
I read about a couple of them.
Jane Mansfield.
Yeah, I read about that. I did a little research this morning.
Wow.
Yeah, Margaret O'Brien.
Right. He said the director said her answers to his questions were too pat.
What does that mean?
I think it means too, like, pre-rehearsed, was my impression.
And you did a Twilight Zone episode.
Yes, I did, with Shelley Berman.
Wow. That's cool. Did you get to meet Rod
No, you know, it's interesting.
Sterling.
You never meet Rod Sterling. I mean, Rod Sterling was so tiny. He was a very small person, but you never see him with anybody else, so you have no idea how big he is.
Right. That's why he's always alone on the screen, so he can look as big as he wants.
But no, I was I was doing a play in Hollywood at the time, you know, and they were running late, and I did make it to the theater, you know, but it made me a little nervous. But it was an interesting job, because I played Shelley when he was talking to himself, so he had somebody to talk to off camera.
We did that with the Alvin and the Chipmunks, the Squeakquel. We played because the chipmunks are animated.
Uh-huh.
We would stand off to the side of the set, and they'd be talking to a tennis ball, but we'd be talking as the chipmunks.
It was a great experience.
So yeah,
that was a fun job, you know. But Shelley would say, I wouldn't read the line like that. They said, no, Shelley, it doesn't matter, because you're going to read the line.
That's hilarious. And Spartacus.
Ah, Spartacus, yes. My scene with Charles Laughton, begging for my mother to be not thrown to the lions.
Oh, geez.
Because she'd stolen some bread.
And okay, so let's talk about Stanley Kubrick really quickly. Just
impressions. Thoughts.
Never said a word to me, you know?
Really?
You say your line, you know?
Right.
Okay, fine, cut, you know.
What was the set? Where did you guys film that?
Universal Studios.
And what was the set? Because that's like that's the iconic Roman kind of the big set and the
well, it's interesting because the sets that I was on, there was all forced perspective. So it's you'd see these sets, but say they'd be wounded lying on the field.
Mm-hmm.
They got the people got smaller and smaller, and finally they were little people, or they'd be dolls way off in the distance.
Whoa,
you know that somebody'd be underneath moving them. You know.
Wow. Wait, yeah. Like real little people?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because they wouldn't be that far away. They would just be pretending that they were that.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's forced. It was really brilliant.
Wow. Sounds like something Rod Serling would do.
That blows my mind.
The scene in Gone with the Wind.
Right.
The scene in the where all the wounded are lying on the field. I think there's a lot of more dummies or people next to the dummies moving the dummy. You know,
I gotta look.
Yeah,
that's
it's, you know the brilliance of Hollywood. You know, mm-hmm. It's just I mean, now with green screens, you can do anything. You know,
but it doesn't look then as good.
No, it doesn't interest me as much as it did with the other thing.
Yeah,
but yeah, one day I was sitting on the set. I sat on the set a lot. And there were no chairs for me. And I just sat in this chair, and then I heard this voice, "Young man, that is my chair." "Yes, Mr. Olivier."
Oh, my God.
You did not sit in his chair.
Oh, my God.
Of all the people to sit in the chair.
But anyway, the scene was cut, you know.
Okay, your scene in Spartacus.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. With John Gavin and Charles Laughton.
Does it exist anywhere that you have?
I don't know. No? They said when they did a re-release, I thought maybe it's there, but probably not.
Can you find yourself anywhere in the movie, like in the
background?
I'm
on the credits.
You're in the credits. Oh, you're going to be somewhere.
Yeah.
So I still get a residual from it.
Well, that's nice.
Yeah.
That's hilarious. Really? Spartacus, 1 cent.
I've been getting I've been getting a lot of 1 cent checks.
Do you still get residuals from Rebel?
No. I think it was like 2 years ago, I got a foreign residual for $17.
Wow. That's
but nobody else did.
That's gross. $17?
What did you spend it on? Did you invest it?
No, the little ones I just send to the Actors Fund, which I think is a good idea.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
Not us.
We save right to the bank. My 15 cents go right to the bank.
New pair of shoes.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just beaming with excitement. You've really created stories in my head that I'll be thinking about for days to come.
What stories? Uh-oh.
No, just these old Hollywood little stories.
It's interesting. Fun. A friend of mine and I are developing a thing called Address Hollywood, and it's about the stars on Hollywood Boulevard walking down. If someone walking down the street on Hollywood Boulevard pointing out, I mean, somebody knows who Elvis Presley is. Somebody knows who Lee Baracci is. But everyone knows who Hattie McDaniel is.
Uh-huh.
Or to know who, oh, God, what is his name? He was our assistant director. He was a big star in the silent films, a Spanish star. And he was our assistant director on Rebel Without a Cause.
Oh, wow.
Don Alvarado, who was Don Page. His screen name was Don Alvarado. And he was the best friend of Jack Warner.
Oh.
Who, Jack Warner.
Head of Warner Brothers.
Married Don Page's wife and adopted Don Page's daughter. And Don Page had a permanent job at Warner Brothers. And Don Page's wife, who became Jack Warner's daughter, plays in Casablanca. She's the man and wife that are trying to get out with Helmut Dantine. That's dumb. Anyway, a really nice man who had this great career. But, you know, there's thousands of us around
mm-hmm.
who've I met a girl just over the weekend. And she has a tobacconist shop in Beverly Hills. She was Wendy on Broadway.
Really?
In Peter Pan.
Wow. I know. It's just there's so many people that are out there that have all these stories to tell.
I know. Wonderful stories.
That's what this whole show is about, really.
Yeah, it is true.
They should. We should have Matt get in touch with you because he would love to talk to a lot of these people.
Well, Jackie Joseph is a dear friend of mine. She was the original Audrey in... Although that plant that ate people.
Little Shop of Horrors.
Yeah.
Wow.
She'd do it.
That's a good thing about actors. They'll do anything.
And she did a series with Doris Day.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's such a fun, rich world to talk about Hollywood in the 60s. It sounds like it's not that different from today, but in my head it is like so glamorous.
Well, I think it's because of the colors we see or don't see when we look back in time. We're like, oh, look at how gauzy it looked back then or whatever. But it's like, no, it looked like this, right? But you know what I mean? Like, we think of the 50s as being like certain colors.
Even
certain,
behind the scenes, it looked like
to us.
A dear friend of mine was a makeup man. He was the head of makeup at RKO. He invented all that rubber application stuff. Maurice Seiderman. And when he was head of at RKO, he said, someone was put under contract. They were brought into a small room with the head of wardrobe, the head of casting, the head of publicity, and they decided what they're going to do to develop this particular person.
Really?
You know, do we do this? Do we do that? He said, like Joan Fontaine, he said, she had no breasts at all. So they had to design things so she looked a little more voluptuous.
And you mean like prosthetics, not plastic surgery?
Yes.
Wow.
No, everything's an illusion.
Even back then.
That scene in the Judy Garland film where they're trying to make her over for her screen test. James Mason, Judy Garland, anyway, you know.
I know two Judy Garland movies, Vivi and St. Louis and Wizard of Oz.
No, this is later on when her career started again. And Barbara Streisand remade the film. That's what you really want on radio is dead air.
Yeah, we'll come back in with the answer being like, it's this movie, of course.
I heard the actresses used to wear a thin gold chain from ear to ear under their neck. Oh, you remember.
I worked on Name of the Game. I was dialogue director on Name of the Game. Mm-hmm. Other various jobs that you do to stay in the business. And everybody on the film, it said they were 30. They were not. They must have been in their late 40s or 30s. But because they were all that old, they could play 30 if everyone's playing 30.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But they all wanted lifts, and they all wore lifts.
Shoes?
No, on their faces.
Oh,
face? Like tape?
Tape. My friend, I became friends with Elsa Landchester, and she worked on a film with Marlena Dietrich. And she said, Marlena went over to Paramount in the morning to come over to Goldwyn and said she did her own makeup, but they put on 9 pairs of lifts. And Elsa ran upstairs and brought me this box and said, these are Marlena Dietrich's lifts.
Oh, my gosh.
And they're like gauze that paste on the side of your face. It pulls everything up with rubber bands, and then there's fish hooks that hook into the gauze, and then all along the hairline, there's little things pulled up to go to rubber bands in the back that holds your face up. And she said they were walking to lunch one day, and Marlena Dietrich was in front of them, and she and Charles were walking down the street, and Charles yelled at her and said, you old whore, where are you going? And he said Marlena couldn't move. She looked wonderful, but she couldn't move. She sort of turned very slowly, turning her head around.
Wow. I wonder, do you think they still use those today?
Oh, yeah.
It's probably harder with HD and all that, though.
Oh my God.
I'd love to try
but
some.
But you don't need it.
I know. Well, thank you. But I'd still like to try it.
Yeah. Well,
you know.
I'll hook you up with a couple of
You have them?
Yeah. Dental floss and a safety pin.
Yeah. But see, you glue the, and then you have to wear a wig.
You have to wear a wig. Yeah. So it's like today people don't use them. Today people just get facelifts or Botox.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's what they do.
Yeah.
Okay, well, this has been
very informative.
A great interview. Yeah, I mean, that really is the stuff I'm fascinated with is
the lifts.
Well, the craft services and the lifts.
Yeah. Well, it's been a pleasure. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me in and having a little chat. I hope there's not too much airtime, blank airtime.
I think only one or two or three little moments, but
and then that's all on our end.
That's on us. Well, thank you so much, Jack.
Thank you.
We'll
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.